From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point. It's been another weekend of whiplash on President Trump's immigration policies. Late last week, an executive order to stop family separation, yet no clear or quick plan on how to reunite families. Then the president called for the end to due process for undocumented immigrants. All this ahead of big immigration votes in Congress and talk of trade, tariffs, and big Supreme Court decisions. This hour on Point, the week ahead in Washington and beyond. You can join us on air or online. What did you make of the latest news from the border this weekend? Do you think families will be reunited? Do you agree with the president that undocumented immigrants should not receive due process? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Nancy Cordes. She's chief congressional correspondent for CBS News. Nancy, always a pleasure.
Hi, John. It's great to be with you.
Also with us from Washington is Eliana Johnson, White House reporter for Politico. Eliana, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me, John.
And with me from Dallas, Texas, is Brendan Miniter. He's vice president and editorial page editor for the Dallas Morning News. Brendan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Brendan, I want to start with you since you're closer to the scene of the action than we are. Give us a sense as we begin the week of what the circumstance is on the border, whether or not we are in the process of getting those children reunited and also getting some sort of organization for how to approach this issue.
Sure. Well, unfortunately, no one can really say whether they're being organized on that or not. They haven't kept good records in terms of where parents are and where children have been sent. So that's the scramble right now. They're trying to figure out how to reconnect these families. I'm hearing stories of parents that went through the process, have been released, and now they're trying to figure out where their children are across the country. They might be in New York, they might be in Chicago, what have you. The bottom line here is that this is a policy that was put in place without a lot of planning about how to actually stay organized and where the parents are and where the children are going. And now that it's been uprooted, there isn't a plan to quickly reunite these families. The good news is that the parents are themselves very active in calling every single number they can possibly find in order to run down their own children. So to some degree, the parents are going to drive the solution to this process.
Brendan, I want to call on two aspects of your biography to get an assessment. Am I correct that you have served in a past Republican administration?
I have not served in administration, but I did work for President George W. Bush after he left office.
Okay. And you're the editorial page editor of the Dallas Morning News, of course. So in light of both of those facts, how would you assess the administrative competence of the administration, whatever you think of their policy, in handling this situation over the last couple of weeks?
Well, sure. A lot of this feels like flying by the seat of the pants. So the president signed an executive order, and then he issues a tweet that seems to countermand at least the spirit of the executive order, drawing a very hard line on how to handle all of this. So it feels very disorganized, and I think that has not been the case in other presidencies. Whether you agree with policy or not, there was a lot of pre-planning, a lot of work to make sure that that no balls were dropped. And in this case, what we're seeing is that, as I say, it's a policy that seems to be made up in the seat of the president's pants and seems to be whipsawed back and forth. And driven for political reasons and not developed for a long-term plan to be successful. Look, there was probably a way to draw a harder line on allowing people into this country without creating this problem of separating families, separating kids and putting kids in cages and that sort of thing. But the president didn't do that. So it feels very disorganized compared to other administrations.
I want to play a clip from the president talking over the weekend and then, Eliana, come to you on the other side. On Saturday, President Trump addressed the 2018 Nevada State Party Convention in Las Vegas, and he had this to say about immigration.
We have the toughest border you can have, considering the laws are the worst of the whole country. Our immigration laws are a laughingstock all over the world. We're the only people. People walk in, they put a foot in. Please, would you like to register? Other countries, they say, get the hell out of here. They do that. They have to do that.
Now, Eliana, the president, in fact, tweeted yesterday that he wants a policy of get the hell out of here. No courts, no legal cases. Is the president serious about trying to make that happen? How do you assess where the administration is headed right now?
You know, John, I think a lot of this immigration policy has been a window into making policy on the fly, led by the president's ill-informed rhetoric with his aides then trying to catch up with him. And I think his tweets over the weekend about denying entry to immigrants on the border are the latest example of that. So it's difficult to know if policy will follow his rhetoric or not. I would note that there is a statute that does confer on the president the power to turn away immigrants at the border without a trial. So he does legally have the right to do that. But it's unclear if that's what the president was referring to, or if he was just sort of talking about something that he wished he had the power to do, as he pointed to other countries. So right now, I think we have to say we don't know if this is merely talk or if it will be followed by policy, as we saw with the sort of herky-jerky back and forth on the executive order last week, reversing something the president said he didn't have the power to do. He then went ahead and did it. And now there's tremendous uncertainty about how to actually implement that.
Nancy Cordes, one of the things that we've been following throughout the Trump administration is the strange relationship between this president and a Congress controlled by his party, many of whom disagree with things he does or the way he does them, but they're ginger about bringing up their disagreements. They've got primaries to worry about, all that sort of thing. If the president is, in fact, serious about denying due process to people who cross the border, how do you assess the way that Republicans in Congress would respond to that?
Well, you know, you have to wonder whether part of the reason that the White House did this on the fly was because they knew that if they really started to make preparations for family separations in a very obvious way, that perhaps Republicans in Congress would have tried to talk them out of it. And now you have a situation where the White House is essentially dumping this problem with the clock ticking on 20 days into Congress's lap in much the same way that it dumped the DACA problem into Congress's lap. Another issue that Republicans were highly reluctant to take up in an election year. And as Eliana knows, the White House on Sunday started sending the message, well, Congress is about to take up a narrow fix, and it's going to do so as early as this week, and they're going to take care of everything. They kind of got ahead of Republican leaders in Congress, trying to put the pressure on them and also trying to send a message, well, if this doesn't get fixed, it's not the White House's fault, it's Congress's fault. It's hard to see at this point, John, the way forward on even a narrow fix. It's not as if, Democrats and Republicans are unified on what should be a part of that narrow fix, how long you should hold children with their parents, and exactly when to hold a vote. So highly uncertain that Congress can get the White House out of this mess within that 20-day window.
Well, Nancy, this is one of the things that's so confusing, because you have tweets that seem to signal a new direction of the debate that are entirely unpredictable. So where do we stand right now on the don't waste your time or do waste your time spectrum?
Well, GOP leaders still feel that they need to hold a vote this week in the House on this broader compromise bill that was hashed out between more moderate Republicans and more conservative Republicans, with GOP leadership kind of overseeing the process. They made this promise to their moderate Republicans that they would hold this vote, and they feel that they need to do it, even though it's looking increasingly likely that that bill will fail. Maybe it won't even get as many votes as the conservative bill that failed last week, which is a big embarrassment for the House Speaker after trying to negotiate this compromise. But they feel that they can't move on to a narrow fix until they've given the moderates this opportunity to vote. And then the question becomes, you know, there are a number of Republicans who have made any number of proposals for how to fix this problem. Do you flood judges to the border to speed up the asylum process once you house children in these detention facilities with their parents? How long do you hold them? There are many Democrats who believe that holding these children in detention facilities, even if they're with their parents, is inhumane if you're doing it for months and months. And we know that the asylum process can take months and months to work out. And then the question also becomes, if they do this narrow fix, but let's say it doesn't include funding for a border wall, will the president sign it or will he get hammered by his base and turn on the legislation as we've seen him do time and time again? So, Congress is, has a very poor track record when it comes to immigration measures, large and small. And, it's unclear whether they can do any better this time than they have in the past.
Eliana, would the president sign a narrow fix?
You know, I don't think that's clear right now. He's indicated to Congress first that he was 1,000% behind them, but he was unclear about which of the bills they were considering he was behind. And now he's told them to hold off until after the midterm election. So the latest signal is no. But again, he's made Congress's work tremendously difficult because of the lack of clear signaling about what exactly he would sign. I agree with Nancy that the narrow bill is much more likely to pass through Congress. There's a House version and a Senate version than any sort of broader bill that tries to combine things together. But it's totally unclear whether the president would sign this. And I think nothing is going to pass within a 20-day window. And the likeliest event is that the Trump administration returns to the policy of the Obama administration, which was to catch and release the folks who are crossing the border.
That would be the ultimate irony of the situation if, after all this, we return to President Obama's policy. Brendan Miniter, Nancy Cordes, Eliana Johnson, stay right there. We're discussing immigration both at the border and on the agenda in Congress. You can join the conversation. Do you think Congress can find a legislative fix to the border crisis? What do you expect to see happen in the votes this week? I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.
July 2016, a woman calls 911.
We got that emergency.
She sees a man who she says looks mentally ill, and she says she thinks he's got a gun, or at least something shaped like a gun. The police come, they shoot, but they shoot the wrong guy. Hear what happened on the Embedded podcast.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood. We're talking about immigration, trouble in restaurants, trade, and tariffs. You can join the conversation. What do you make of Sarah Huckabee Sanders and other Trump officials getting jeered at restaurants? What right to privacy do they have, if any? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests today are Nancy Cordes, Chief Congressional Correspondent for CBS News, Eliana Johnson, White House reporter for Politico, and Brendan Miniter, Vice President and Editorial Page Editor for the Dallas Morning News. Brendan, we ended the last segment talking to Nancy and Eliana about this chaotic situation in Congress and uncertainty as to how they're going to proceed. As an editorial matter, what does your newspaper want Congress and the administration to do right now?
Well, from the very beginning of this crisis, we called for not separating families. We said this is just simply not the kind of country we want to be. That's not who we are as a people. So what we've called for and what we'll continue to call for, I think, is a humanitarian approach here, not separating families and understanding the complexities of this problem. You can't simply keep families together and hold them indefinitely. It's going to take a lot longer than 20 days. As anyone has ever taken a look at how these cases play out in court, they take quite a long time, and it's very complex and hard to sort through it. You know, here in Dallas, I think a lot of people may forget, but the Texas is very much at the forefront of this crisis for lots of reasons. We're seeing that the detention centers themselves are here in Texas. The processing center that they're now going to try to work through with these families is here in Texas. But here in Dallas, there's about 475,000 illegal immigrants just in the Dallas area alone. There's 1.6 million in Texas. So Texans are used to dealing with this and understand this from, I think, a human level in a way that maybe you may not if you don't see it as as clearly as I think you can here in Texas. I mean, many people know people who whose legal status is such that it's in question, or their members or their family here. You know, one member's legal and the other member is not. So it's a very personal issue here on the ground, and we're very much in favor of solutions that that recognize that we're dealing with real people.
All right, let's go to the phones. We've got callers standing by. Ingrid is on the line from Gulfport, Florida. Ingrid, welcome to the show. And I just have to tell you, I started my career in St. Petersburg at the Times, and so I'm quite familiar with Gulfport.
Well, it's still weird and great.
Great. Go ahead. What's your question?
Yeah, my question, and I'm so glad you have media people there, because I get both confused and concerned at the language that's being used around these issues. We use almost interchangeably immigrant, asylum seeker, migrants, refugees, and each one carries a different meaning, as well as, I would imagine, different policies. And some of the fervor that gets stirred up is around illegal immigrants, when in fact we often have migrants who are working in agriculture. We have many asylum seekers who are legitimately seeking safety from any number of things happening in their home countries. And so there's no clarification, certainly from the administration, but even the media doesn't seem to make the distinction. And many times it's calling refugees migrants, and I get confused. You know, what are we really talking about here? So I'm wondering if your guest or you can help clarify what are the policies in the media about using terminology, and is there any way to shape the conversation so that we can have more compassion for people who are truly leaving untenable situations in their home countries and understand why they are trying to come here?
Thanks for the call, Ingrid. And Nancy Cordes, I want to go to you. There are two aspects to this language. One is the language of legal status that Ingrid was talking about. There's also the question of the language used to describe people, the president using words like infest the country. He famously a few weeks ago talked about some illegal immigrants who are members of gangs being animals, not people. How do you think members of Congress are sorting out both the emotional component of the descriptions of those people and also the legal distinctions between asylum seeker, migrant, et cetera?
Right. Right. I mean, if you listen to some of that language, you would assume that the majority of violent crime in this country is being committed by people who cross the border illegally, which we know is not the case. Actually, the crime rate among immigrants and illegal immigrants is lower than the rest of the population. But I sympathize, Ingrid, because it is very confusing, you know, and there is a lot of overlap. When you talk about asylum, for example, part of the reason that so-called asylum seekers were crossing the border illegally is that when they were told to by the administration that they should go to one of the legal checkpoints, they were being turned away and they weren't allowed to come across. You know, then we also know that a significant percentage of people who do apply for asylum don't necessarily meet the definition and are deported. We also know that this administration is now trying to change the definition of who can qualify for asylum. So there's a great deal of confusion in the country, and there's a great deal of confusion, frankly, among lawmakers about what the administration's policy is and its reasons for it. And that's partly because, you know, we got so much conflicting information from the White House itself. You know, this is a policy. It isn't a policy. It's meant as a deterrent. It's not meant as a deterrent. That is confusing to reporters, to average Americans, and to lawmakers alike, even lawmakers of the president's own party.
I got to say, I've been covering Washington a long time, and that is one of the first times when you have seen explicitly members of an administration contradicting one another on critical elements of their policy, mm-hmm. what it is and what it isn't. But I want to shift gears here to something that relates to the emotional component we're talking about, and it has to do with an incident that occurred over the weekend. I think that since Charlottesville, this crisis with family separation is probably the most emotionally intense controversy surrounding President Trump and his administration. And as a consequence of that, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the White House press secretary, and family members or friends were kicked out of a restaurant in Lexington, Virginia, because employees of the restaurant did not want to serve them because of opposition to the president's policies and rhetoric, et cetera. That produced a huge storm of discussion over the weekend, including this comment by Carlos Gutierrez, the former Commerce Secretary under George W. Bush. He had this to say about that incident. Let's take a listen.
I'm not worried about Sarah Huckabee Sanders. I'm worried about the African-American kid in school who gets harassed by kids who think they have a license to harass because the president says so. I'm worried about the Hispanic kid, the Hispanic-American citizen, who is harassed at school and called a member of MS-13 because the president calls immigrants from Hispanic countries members of MS-13.
Eliana, what's your perception of where this particular controversy is going? Because, boy, you start turning up the temperature on public interactions between private individuals and public officials who are going about their private life. It strikes me as something that could get out of control.
I agree with you, John. And I think Carlos Gutierrez is essentially saying that, you know, it's okay to harass or kick out of your restaurant. Sarah is probably the tamest example, but we did have Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen, you know, meeting protests outside of her private home, and Stephen Miller, the president's advisor, you know, being harassed inside a restaurant. So there
were several incidents. Stephen Miller was trying to make that happen.
It could be. I'm not as familiar with the details of that incident, but, you know, so I think what he's saying is that, well, anybody who works for the Trump administration in a visible role is aiding and abetting the president's policies, and it's okay to do these sorts of things to them. I don't really agree with them, even though these people are perfectly within their constitutional rights to do these things. I tend to just feel personally that elevating political disagreements to, you know, matters of personal character or personal hatred, it's just not the sort of society that I want to live in. And I think that this preceded Trump, where, you know, political disagreements were so heated that people were not treating each other in a really civil way. And I do think it's dangerous because, you know, I don't think people would want conservatives harassing members of the next Democratic administration. And I just think, it's more of a matter of civility than it is, you know, aiding and abetting. I would characterize it that way rather than aiding and abetting, you know, the Trump administration's racism.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Martha on the line from Menominee, Wisconsin. Sorry, Martha, I mangled that. Martha, you're on point. Go right ahead.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking this call. The people have had enough. They wanted the Hobby Lobby decision. The conservatives, the Republicans, they got it. We are not going to serve or be party to racism anymore. I live in middle America, and even out here in the hinterlands, the flyover country, I live in a college town. UW Stout is here. And it's all over town. People have had enough. More power to people for calling out these racists. I've been doing it in my private life, my public life. If you're a supporter of Trump, you are complicit. You are complicit, and you are going to have to face the music and let the chips fall where they may.
Brendan Miniter, you heard the Carlos Gutierrez sound we played a moment ago. What do you think about Martha's point, who's saying that, no, if you disagree and disagree strongly, this is what you ought to do?
Well, I guess I'd make two points. One is that grace goes a long way and is critically important for a free society. To give someone the grace and hear them out and actually be willing to discuss even tough ideas with them. I think that's incumbent upon all of us. It's something we can do in our private life. If Sarah Huckabee Sanders comes into your restaurant, it's something you can do, you can personally do. So I don't think that we should encourage going down this road of vilifying or attacking or just making these fights very sort of personal in that respect. But I'll say something in terms of Gutierrez. You say there's something to what he has to say, and that is that we hear a lot from Republicans that they support different policies and that sort of thing. But I'd say when you look at a president, that his public leadership matters a lot, and I think that's what Gutierrez is getting at. Is when the president says just labels everyone from Hispanic origin who may have immigrated to this country to be a member of MS-13 or calling animals and that sort of thing, it does give license to people to actually not show grace to others. And so I think the public leadership of a president, of how he talks, how he treats other people, people follow that. People emulate that. People say, hey, that's something that that I can do in my private life, or that's the way to engage in public discourse. So I think the president is fanning a lot of those flames and encouraging a lot of this acrimonious behavior that's spilling out now, I think, in a very personal way in communities. I think all of this is destructive for the debates that we need to have in terms of solving the big problems that face this country. We have a lot of problems that we have to solve. We have to find a way we all live in the same country, to work together to solve them. We're not going to do that if we treat each other without at least a little bit of grace.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Kathleen on the line from Dayton, Ohio. Kathleen, welcome to On Point.
Yeah. Hey, I do not support. I think I would be qualified as a lefty, and I'm not a supporter of the Trump administration, and I do not support people being harassed, Sarah Huckabee Sanders or anybody else, in a restaurant or out in public when they're leading their private lives. So I don't support that. But I want to ask a question about the language another woman brought up earlier. What does it serve when Rachel Maddow and Guest and people like that refer to these holding facilities, and I'm not into the separation of families whatsoever, when they refer to them as Nazis or concentration camps? I mean, I find that way over the top. And I'd also ask you, John, to do a show on ICE and why we don't see people jailed and fined for hiring illegal immigrants. I live in Boulder part of the year and Dayton, Ohio part of the year. And there are wealthy families hiring immigrants at like $8 and $10 an hour. I've talked with them. You know, why don't we talk about, fining and jailing those who hire?
Kathleen, thanks so much for your call. Brendan, let me put the question to you. Do you think the Nazi imagery is overblown and out of place in this discussion?
I do, and I think it's dangerous to go that far, because then what it does is it gives license to people to dismiss it. And I think it's I think that you can say the policies are inhumane. You can call it for exactly what it is. I think it's cruel, but I think if you go too far with that and call it Nazi, like the facts, you go back to World War II, learn the facts of what happened in the Holocaust, learn what happened in Nazi Germany in the 30s and the 40s, and really say, is that what's happening in the United States right now? It's simply not the same. Now, does that mean that the policies that lead to separation of families are inhumane? Absolutely does. But when you draw, I think when you use that imagery too much, what happens is, or use it at all, what happens is people can then dismiss it, and then it just further polarizes the country and doesn't actually get to us to a debate where we can actually debate the facts.
Well,
I think we need to get to a point.
Speaking of polarization, I want to play one clip and come to you, Nancy, on the other side. At a rally in Los Angeles on Saturday, California Democratic Representative Maxine Waters called for the continued heckling of members of the Trump administration.
If you see anybody from that cabinet in a restaurant, in a department store, at a gasoline station, you get out and you create a crowd. And you push back on them. And you tell them they're not welcome anywhere.
Nancy, is Maxine Waters isolated among Democrats? Have you heard Democrats since she made this statement distancing themselves and saying, whoa, turn down the temperature, that's not what we want?
I think that most Democrats view that kind of rhetoric as not just unhelpful, but also as a means to quickly surrendering the the higher ground on this issue. But I do think that what you're seeing over the last week or two is about more than a political disagreement. There was a reason that you're seeing Sarah Huckabee Sanders getting kicked out of a restaurant now, or people protesting Kirstjen Nielsen in a restaurant, and you didn't see that the first 18 months of this administration. And that is because this particular issue has gone above and beyond right versus left. When you've got Republicans saying that this is an inhumane policy, clearly people are frustrated and they want to show it. Doesn't make it right, but you know, there's a lot of fear in this country about where things are headed.
I agree with you. I must say, from my perspective in having covered politics, is my presumption has always been the response is to vote as opposed to harass somebody in public. But you guys hold right there. Brendan Miniter, Nancy Cordes, Eliana Johnson. We're discussing the week ahead in Washington and beyond. I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.
Whether it's athlete protests, the Muslim travel ban, gun violence, school reform, or just the music that's giving you life right now, race is the subtext to so much of the American story. And on Code Switch, we make that subtext text. You can listen to us on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood. We're talking about primaries this week leading up to midterm elections and the Trump trade policy. You could join the conversation. How do you expect Mitt Romney to do in tomorrow's Utah primary? Do you think immigration will be a major issue? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests today are Nancy Cordes, chief congressional correspondent for CBS News, Eliana Johnson, White House reporter for Politico, and Brendan Miniter, vice president and editorial page editor for the Dallas Morning News. Another issue that is unresolved and has been for some time is the president's policy on trade, in particular trade with China. During his speech in Las Vegas over the weekend, President Trump talked about that issue this way.
Now we have to work on our trade with China because it's been very tough on our country for very many years. Our presidents did nothing about it. And we probably lost last year $500 billion in trade to China. Think of it, $500 billion. So we've started a process, and I think that'll work out with China because we have a very good relationship with the president. With President Xi, is incredible. So I think that'll work out.
Now, Eliana, let's talk about that for a second. First of all, the $500 billion figure doesn't make any sense. Our trade deficit with China was $375 billion, but of course that just means we bought a lot of stuff from China. I've been confused, as I imagine everyone has been, by the president zigging and zagging here. He's talked tough on China during the campaign on currency, on trade. He backed off on currency. Then he romanced President Xi to get cooperation on North Korea. He put on tariffs. Then they had talks. The talks didn't go anywhere. He put ZTE out of business. Then he put it back in business. Where is he going on this?
It's not totally clear right now. He announced the tariffs, and then China just announced that it is preparing retaliatory tariffs aimed right at heartland states that President Trump won. And it's not clear right now if the political consequences of the tariffs that Trump announced will be enough to dissuade him from following through with this. The chief concern there is the tariffs on soybeans, which China buys from American farmers and which would hit hard in states like Wisconsin, Minnesota, which was very close, and states in which many Republicans are up for re-election in November and that could swing Democratic if they're hit hard economically by these tariffs.
And Harley-Davidson indicated over the weekend that they're going to shift production because of retaliatory tariffs, you know, back and forth between EU and Washington.
Right. I think that's an indication, obviously, that the economic consequences of these tariffs are already being felt. And what Republicans really worry about is if they had their druthers, they'd be running on the tax cuts passed 6 or 7 months ago. And that would be their only message. That's totally been overshadowed by this immigration controversy and now by these tariffs. And I think that their chief concern is whatever economic benefits middle class and lower middle class voters may have reaped from the tax cuts will be undone by the tariffs.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Bill on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. Bill, welcome to On Point.
Hey, John, how are you?
Go right ahead.
I'm here. I can hear you.
I can hear you, too. Go ahead. You're live.
Well, my comment is, it's interesting how your guests seem to look at the very short-term situation with trade. Fact of the matter is, we've been taken advantage of, and it's been allowed by administrations for up to 20, 30 years, where gradually we have been taken advantage of over and over in increasing amounts. I think the president is trying to at least address the issue and right the table. I don't think he has all the answers nor all the figures, but substantially, we are on the negative end of all of these deals that he is looking at.
Bill, what do you think about the blowback for people who may be sympathetic to that argument and support Trump, but they're a soybean farmer or they make cheese in Wisconsin and they get caught up in the back and forth? Are the changes that he's talking about worth that price?
I think long term they are. I think Americans have looked at short term gains everywhere. We're talking about long-term philosophical changes in trade to make them equitable for everyone. That is simply not the way it is today. And quite frankly, the media doesn't even cover that part of it.
Bill, thanks so much for your call. Brendan Miniter, you worked for George W. Bush, who, of course, is and was a free trader. And he's one of the people that President Trump is lashing out at when he talks about the inept political leadership on trade previously. How do you see this argument?
Sure. You know, I think the president is tapping into an emotion on trade that probably is welling up for several reasons, starting with the disappearance of for example, manufacturing jobs around the country. Anyone who's driven across the country, and I've driven across it a lot, will pass through towns that just has old boarded up factories. And I think people look at that and say, you know what, trade did that to us. That factory's now in China, that factory's now in Mexico, and that sort of thing. But I think, unfortunately, that's not quite right. That's not exactly what's happening. I went back in part because I get a lot of letters from folks expressing sentiments similar to the caller, and just said, you know, what do the actual figures tell us? And what I find is that you go back to 1990 or even further, about five, you know, growing from 5 to 10% of the jobs in the country were tied to trade. Today, it's around 22%. If you look at global trade patterns over the last 50 years, what you're finding is that we have a much more specialized and complex trading economy. What that really means, and I see this a lot here in Texas, is that goods will cross the border 5, 6, 7 times before they get to a finished product. So it'll be started in a factory in the United States. It'll be moved to Mexico to be finished. It'll be moved to Canada for more finishing. Parts will come from China. All these things get wrapped up into a final product that is then sold. When you put tariffs on that in any place, what happens is that those what we call logistical supply chains get uprooted ultimately, and those cost American jobs, and those actually hurt American workers. They don't just drive up costs; they actually cost American jobs. That's the nature of a specialized economy. And that's, you know, always been true, but it's been increasingly true that the modern economy of this country relies on trade in order to grow. So when I see those facts, I run up against the emotions that I see out in the country, and I think what that really is stemming from is that we have a dynamic economy that's changing a lot, and people feel like they're getting left behind, or they're feeling like the modern economy is not built for them. And in a lot of ways, people are getting left behind, and that's a significant problem. So the president speaks to that, but unfortunately, I don't think his solutions actually speak to it and actually lead to lead to a stronger economy down the road. So he's promising a lot of things that just the numbers tell us aren't going to actually pan out.
Well, and also, Brendan, I think it deals with a classic asymmetry in that you may have trade policies enacted to protect particular industries, and they may protect a small number of people in those industries, but it is harder to see and perceive the fact that many millions more Americans benefit from either lower input prices or lower consumer prices when they go to Walmart or wherever. And how do you manage that trade-off between a small number of people who could lose or gain a lot and much larger numbers who would be better off?
Well, that's exactly right. I think I'll give NAFTA to you for an example. A lot of people are critical of NAFTA. It's in a trade agreement we have with Mexico and Canada. It's led to strong supply chains within all those countries. But with NAFTA now on the table, what Mexico is doing is saying, well, we're going to strike different trade deals with other countries if we can't do this with the United States. And if you talk to the Mexico side of the NAFTA negotiators, what they'll tell you is that they look at companies that are building factories in Mexico that may enter our supply chain and sell goods in the United States and partly manufacture those goods in the United States, they're just going to pick up their factories and move them to Asia, where instead of – they won't face a 25% tariff, they'll face a 2.5% tariff. So what'll happen is it's not necessarily all these factories come back to the United States. They'll just go to other countries where the tariffs are a little less, and it'll be very disruptive around the world, but it doesn't at the end of the day create jobs here in the United States.
Now, this is one issue where Republican members of the House and Senate, many of them, do have a pretty good grasp of the subject. Here's Republican Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona on ABC's This Week yesterday saying he's willing to use the approval of Trump judicial nominees as a bargaining chip to force lawmakers to do something on tariffs and trade.
Unless we can actually exercise something other than just approving the president's executive calendar, his nominees, judges, that we have no reason to be there. So I think myself and a number of senators, at least a few of us, will stand up and say, let's not move any more judges until we get a vote, for example, on tariffs.
Nancy, holding up judges is pretty strong stuff in the Republican Party right now. Do you think that Jeff Flake is any more serious about this than the other periodic fire alarms he has pulled about aspects of President Trump's policies that haven't really resulted in much?
He does appear to be more serious because he is actually putting some action behind his words. And critically, he is not alone. You had the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Corker, on Face the Nation this weekend, saying that the president is abusing his authority by using Section 232 of the Trade Act, essentially saying that he's imposing these tariffs on allies like Mexico and Canada because of national security concerns. And he argued that there's a jailbreak brewing. Those were his words. Essentially that Republicans who have been reluctant thus far to be too open about criticizing the president on this issue got a taste of jailbreak on the family separation issue, and they're ready for more. You know, Republicans have been relatively quiet because they assumed that the president would back off, as he has several times before, as you pointed out, John, once other countries started to retaliate with their own tariffs or once the stock market took a hit. So they were sort of hoping that these external forces would do their work for them and they wouldn't have to confront the president on this issue. But it's one that they feel very strongly about, and I think it's quite possible that we could see a shift from the party as some of these retaliatory measures escalate, and people do start to talk more and more about a trade war.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Benjamin on the line from Columbus, Ohio. Benjamin, welcome to On Point. Go right ahead.
Hi, John. Thanks for taking my call. I hope this isn't redundant. My question is concerning the tariffs and the ensuing trade war. I do hear a lot of criticism, on both sides of the president's policies. My question more is, what can we do as a nation to really have other countries play with us on an equal playing field, where they're not charging high tariffs and being protectionist with their markets to allow our goods into their economy and vice versa? I mean, what else can be done besides what the president is possibly proposing, what other solutions are at his disposal?
Good question, Benjamin. Eliana, set aside Peter Navarro and the trade hawks within the White House, what would my friend Larry Kudlow or Steven Mnuchin say are alternatives to tariffs?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think what presidents in the past have done are to strike free trade agreements. So that's what NAFTA was, which was to say we're going to trade goods freely in on the American continent, U.S., Canada, Mexico. President Trump has liked the idea of striking bilateral free trade agreements with other countries, which would do the same thing. What the president objects to, though, and what I think bipartisan leaders object to in turn of his view is that he thinks that if the U.S. buys more goods from a country than it buys from us, that's unfair. And I think he objects to some of the smaller details in some of these free trade deals. But by and large, I think over the past, 40, 50, 60 years, it's these free trade deals that have allowed goods to flow more or less unfettered between countries and over borders that have served as a solution for the problem that the caller raises.
Nancy, I want to go to the primary season, which is not over. In fact, there are primaries tomorrow. And one of the people that we're watching, who's been very interesting over the years, of course, he was the Republican presidential nominee in 2012, accepting the endorsement of Donald Trump. Then he became a fierce critic of President Trump and drew a lot of blowback. Now he's in the Senate race. He was unable to win at the state convention, and now he faces a primary. What do you expect in that primary, Nancy? And what do you expect if he survives and enters the Senate from Mitt Romney?
So he did not manage to secure the nomination at that convention. But a recent Salt Lake Tribune poll showed him ahead by 42 percentage points. So he does appear to be the overwhelming favorite in Utah. And Romney has been walking an interesting fine line in this race. He has, been relatively mild in his criticism of President Trump's zero-tolerance immigration policy. He has said that he agrees with Laura Bush that we need a more compassionate answer. But he has been willing on other issues to take on the president more more in a more full-throated manner. And of course, Utah is an interesting case study in and of itself because there are a lot of Republicans in that Mormon-heavy state who have taken issue with the president on a number of fronts. He doesn't have quite the support there that he does in other red states, and so that's one of the reasons that Romney has felt more comfortable speaking out.
Nancy Cordes, chief congressional correspondent for CBS News, thanks so much for being with us this hour.
Thanks for having me.
Eliana Johnson, White House reporter for Politico. Great to have you.
Thanks, John.
And Brendan Minitzer, vice president and editorial page editor for the Dallas Morning News. Thank you so much for being with us, too.
Well, thanks for having me.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Pohl, Jeremy Rioso, James Ross, Grace Tatter, Gretchen Voss, and Miriam Wasser, with help from Carolyn Anders. This is On Point.